looking at the impact, if there were to be sequestration, looking at the impact of expected cuts on R&D, climate risk mitigation system. So what I'm going to do is just go quickly through our results, and then I'm going to have each of the three panelists here give very, very short comments on their, what the impact of sequestration would be on their institutions, market industries, and then we'll open up for some questions, and we will adjourn precisely at 1:45. So before I start, I should just have my colleague Justin Hicks raise his hand. Justin is a senior economist at ICIF, and he did a year long call for me. I'm going to take all the credit. So wonderful and in-depth work on this stuff. So, okay, so what are we doing with this report? We're looking, as I said, at the impact of sequestration if it were to occur on the U.S. Federal R&D base. And then we're looking at, we're doing an analysis of the impact of those potential cuts on GDP, the knowledge base, and employment, and so that's what the potential path of sequestration is. It's a little hard to read, but the CBO baseline, which is similar to the OMB numbers, basically set a baseline of which sequestration could come off of no increase in federal R&D in nominal dollars between now and 2021. Now, it's important to recognize what that CBO baseline represents. That CBO baseline represents kind of historic freeze in federal R&D investments. Historically, federal R&D investments have grown at about 20% faster than the rate of GDP over the last 15 to 20 years. So that orange line is the R&D to GDP ratio. So were it to actually slacken a bit from its historical growth pattern and just grow at GDP, it would grow that orange line. So that's one of the other benchmarks we're using for our analysis. We're using three benchmarks. One is just sequestration compared to just a CBO flatline, which is, in this case, absolute cuts in nominal and real. The CBO baseline is absolute cuts, but not in nominal dollars. So because of inflation, that the CBO baseline is a cut in real dollars, not in nominal. And then the gray line is basically what we would need to do if we were to keep pace with the last decade or so of increases in Chinese R&D. And the reason we put that in there is that it's more of just a speculation or an indication of what are some of our major competitors doing now in this space. And if we wanted to keep up with them in this critical portion of the U.S. economy, the innovation economy, the innovation space, what would we need to do? Okay, so let me back up just a second here and say, essentially what we did, so how do we take R&D decline numbers and then translate them into impacts on the economy? And luckily, there's actually a very rich and growing academic scholarly literature that looks at the impacts of R&D and federal R&D on things like the number of patents, things like the number of jobs, things like productivity and GDP growth. And that literature is all reviewed in the report. And without getting into too much details, but essentially, what's called elasticity is a very wide range between about 0.07 and 0.60. So wide elasticity. We chose a very, very modest elasticity of 0.13. So we could have chosen an elasticity of 0.60 and these numbers would have been a lot higher. But there is a general, very strong consensus in the scholarly literature that studies innovation that federal R&D dollars do have big impacts in the real economy. So, what are those impacts? Certainly, these are the R&D shortfalls themselves, I should say. So if you look at sequestration at 2011, we're talking about the freeze playing about $12 billion less in 2013. And over that period, 2013-2021, we're talking about a shortfall of $95 billion, a cumulative shortfall of less R&D, federal R&D investment than otherwise occurred. If we wanted to go to the historic part, a little bit less of the historic rate of growth on federal R&D, we're talking about a much bigger shortfall as that shortfall, the benchmark growth, up to $330 billion over that period of time. And if we wanted to just say our goal is to match the Chinese R&D investment. We're talking about essentially a $500 billion shortfall. $500 billion. So, I mentioned this before, I think myself, it's pretty clear evidence, as I said, that R&D drives innovation and growth. I will argue that that is really without dispute. So, what are the impacts? If we were to look at a questioner, and we just did the CBO freeze, and that's the baseline, we will end up with essentially $203 billion less in cumulative GDP over that period of time. If we said our baseline really is growing historically at the rate of GDP growth, we're talking about a $565 billion shortfall. And if we were to match China, that would be $160 billion. So just to be clear, these are not, which we can talk a little bit about later, these are not Keynesian effects, if you will, sort of government money coming out of the economy and then there's a gap of demand. These are not Keynesian effects. We didn't model Keynesian effects on GDP. These are simply innovation and growth effects. The economy has less growth potential. Firms are less productive. Firms are less innovative by that amount. Just put that in perspective, there's a lot of different numbers we use, but that's $203 billion number. That would be equivalent to, after you take out the savings of $100 billion, and let's just say we gave it back to taxpayers in an across-the-board tax cut, U.S. taxpayers would still be out all of the attendance that they have at professional sports games for 6 years. Or another way to put that would be we'd be going with half of a year of all new car and truck purchases in America. So these are big losses that American consumers and taxpayers will ultimately face if we go through with that. The R&D cuts would reduce the amount of knowledge that we produce as an economy in America. We would estimate that over that period, again, 7.8% fewer journal articles and 2.8% fewer patents. Then we're a little steeper right away. Now, this is the number that everybody is obviously most concerned about, which is jobs, particularly in the economy. We're far from the point when the CBO says 2018, before we get back to full employment. So what we did there was we measured two effects. What you would normally think of as the Keynesian effect. So in an economy where there's less than full employment, taking away federal spending leads to unemployment. Everybody seems to have a bipartisan consensus that that's true with defense spending. A lot of people on both sides of the aisle say with defense spending, we're going to have higher job loss. It's true of the same thing on the R&D side. You take money away and researchers and people who are making research and the like, lay people off, that we're going to get higher unemployment. And that leads to essentially over that period of time, which we only model for 4 years, that leads to about 117,000 fewer jobs in the U.S. economy every year. But there's this what we would call the Schumpeterian effect, which is this is the effect of companies being able to be more innovative, therefore there are new business startups, therefore there are companies that develop new products and to add more jobs, and that's the 81,000. So for a total of about 200,000 jobs fewer. I was just interviewed yesterday for a German business magazine about a story about one of the major investment banks argued that the new iPhone will raise global GDP by some amount. That's somewhat sort of similar to this story. This innovation that goes on, people will innovate things because of federal R&D, and they'll not only raise productivity and growth, but people will say, I want to buy this new because of federal R&D. And that will lead to higher companies. So, bottom line, if we were to cut R&D by that amount, we could expect on net 200,000 fewer jobs. It's not to say there won't be other jobs compensating job growth, but we will be 200,000 off of where we would have been otherwise. So, last point I'll just say, it's hard to see that that's actually the plate. And the point is, yes, clearly the federal budget deficit is a serious problem. Seriously, at some point we have to deal with it, if not now, at some point. But our argument would be cutting investment, particularly critical investment in R&D, is not really the right thing to do. We shouldn't put everything on the table. We should put a lot on the table, but certainly not R&D. For one simple reason, if nothing else, R&D raises growth. Growth, in turn, raises federal tax revenues because the economy is bigger, and therefore makes it easier to address structural budget challenges. So with that, I'm going to quickly introduce our panelists and just go right down the line in order here. Edward Asika is the Senior Vice President and President of Customer Channels for Thermo Fisher Scientific. I'm not going to read these for all of them. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to just really need to talk about it. Thermo Fox Fisher Scientific is a scientific instrument company doing the quarter in Boston. Fred Downey is Vice President, Charge of National Security for the Aerospace Industries Association. That's the name implied. It's a trade association that deals with the U.S. aerospace building and defense. Hunter Rawlings is the President of America, Association of American Universities, which again is the association of the major universities, or a group of major universities in the country. He was also former president of Cornell University. Peter McPherson is the president of the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities. APLU is essentially the many state universities around the country who do an incredible amount of research. Ian Steff is the vice president of Global Policy and Technology Partnerships for the Semiconductor Industry Association. SIA is a trade association representing the major and finally, Ronnie Andrews is the president of Medical Sciences for Life Technologies. They're a San Diego-based company that specializes in incredible new advanced technologies around genetic sequencing and underlying technologies. So with that, we're just going to be down the line and start with Andrew. Do you want to go from there?
Can you hear me? So I'm at the Seek, I'm a Thermo Fisher Scientific. And that's a little bit better. There we go. So I'm a Thermo Fisher Scientific, and why are we here participating today? It's really because we're the leader in the life science tool industry. Our laboratory instruments, as well as our consumables and equipment, are used by virtually every scientist in the academic and research institutions globally. But any about Seek frustration, scientists who perform government-funded research really rely on us for everything at Thermo Fisher Scientific, from cutting-edge analytical instruments to the freezers to the basic consumables they use. We enable those scientists to further advance healthcare and diagnostics, topics that are extremely important to us. From a company perspective, I mean, healthcare objectives that we have in this country are pretty obvious. First, we need to improve the quality of our care for patients. The outcome of that will actually result in lowering the cost of the care over the long term, and NIH funding is critical to this path. It's critical for them for that fact that it helps achieve the objectives of science and continue to drive research. The objectives enable research to take place as well as advancements can be made. In addition to that, shortchanging the funding and shortchanging the critical funding around research, it will become an important growth driver and will actually slow down the growth. When I think about this, our company sees the NIH funding as an important growth driver. Last year, we saw a slowdown among our academic and government customers after the debt ceiling debate last summer and fall. As many of our customers who face this uncertainty in the NIH and other research and development budgets put many of their purchases on hold. While the customers put their purchasing on hold, it affects companies like Thermo Fisher Scientific, which employs nearly 20,000 people in the U.S. Why does that affect us? Because as customers put purchasing on hold, we as a company aren't having products purchased. We have to reassess our ability to provide those products, and ultimately it causes us to lay off and close down facilities. I think the other aspect of this, as funding continues to slow, as a company, we have to assess where we put our investments. So if we think about that, we're going to continue to put our investments in those regions that are growing. If NIH funding is cut because of sequestration, we as a company will invest in those regions outside of the United States, where investments will continue to be driven forward. That's why we're here today to continue to advocate for a deal to be put in place that does not include sequestration. I think even more important, the lack of funding stops progress that is being made today, progress that is critical to tackling issues that are fundamental to this world. Here in the U.S. and worldwide, as a world leader in serving science, we have a responsibility to set an example to Thermo Fisher Scientific. We take that seriously as a company. In addition to that, we should take that responsibility seriously as a country.
Come on,
out for you. There's a bunch of seats right up here. There's a few of you to come on up and have a seat for 45 minutes.
Thanks, Rob. And I'd like to say thank you to you and Jessica for producing a report that shines a really bright light on the unaccepted costs of sequestration and innovation. Along with the other reports that have been out there, this one ought to be the final nail in sequestration's coffin. I seriously doubt the ability. Innovation is really important to us in aerospace because innovation is the history of aerospace. It's allowed us to change the way Americans work, travel, and do business. And it's provided us with military dominance for over half a century. Today, about half the GDP of the United States comes from innovation. A lot of that is aerospace. How much? Well, in 2011, aerospace sales were $216 billion. $85 billion of that were exports, and $56 billion as positive trade balance. No other manufacturer can match that record. So, we're the global leaders in aerospace. Unfortunately, that leads to risk. You hear footsteps. Canada, Brazil, and China are catching up fairly rapidly in technology. And unfortunately, they're catching up partly because R&D spending in the United States is down about 60% since 1964. And in some estimates have China surpassing us in that in the next decade. Well, I won't talk in any numbers here, but I'm going to focus on one point. Aerospace innovation requires talent, money, and customers. Talent's really the key. In order to discover new knowledge and turn that into the leading products, you've got to have money and you have to have customers. Otherwise, you're not going to have talent. And sequestration really hits the aerospace talent. The numbers are brutal. If sequestration goes into effect, we're going to lose over 2 million jobs, and a million of them are aerospace and defense. We just put out a report today that shows that 900,000 of those are going to be small business jobs, and we all know a lot of innovation comes there. And that's really going to have an impact on our future talent, too. So, this is devastating to innovation. Sequestration is absolutely devastating. And in fact, sequestration is stupid on so many levels that it's hard to believe that we're still talking about this. We have a second to none campaign, unprecedented for the aerospace industry, to bring this to the attention and hopefully get some action. And we work with a lot of other groups. I really appreciate being able to work with you all on this. Sequestration is just terrible. We have to stop it now. And my sequestration talk says we have 103 days to do that.
Thank you. Well, it's hard to say it much better or more succinctly than Fred just did. It's stupid and it's terrible. So I'll pile on a little bit. I'm Hunter Rawlings with the Association of American Universities. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very happy this report came out when it did, because as Fred says, it's late in the day now, and this report, I hope, will drive home the essential message, which is sequestration would be a disaster for our nation's research universities, as well as for our businesses and our economic growth. And it's important, I think, to underline how much business leaders support federal funding of university research. I want to underline this point as strongly as I can. Often we hear that universities don't have the support of this or that community. Business leaders strongly support federal funding for university research. And it's not just because they're altruistic, but because that research is crucial to their businesses and to the success of their businesses. I mean, just think about the IT industry for a moment. That industry didn't exist 30 or 25 years ago. There was no IT industry. Well, there is a powerful IT industry today. It is a leadership role played by the U.S., and much of that industry came out of university laboratories. discoveries made by research scientists who enabled that industry to get off the ground, to have its scientific foundation. So this is essential to a large part of American business, and as we pointed out already today, roughly 50%, and you can get arguments around this a little bit, but the general consensus is you're safe in saying roughly 50% of U.S. economic growth comes from innovation. And innovation stems often and well from university research. So this is a crucial point, I think, for policymakers to consider, to recognize how devastating it would be, not simply to our universities, which are the best in the world today, but to our businesses and industry, if we begin to cut off this lifeline of support for research. And remember, it's the federal government that supports basic research. Industry, for the most part, does not. And so it's crucial for us to maintain this lifeblood for our research enterprise. So as we gather here today to urge Congress and the President, actually to remonstrate with Congress and the President, to get together after the election and do what they need to do to prevent a sequester. That, I think, is absolutely essential. It's in everyone's interest. And I finished 8 seconds early.
You yield the balance of your time.
2 minutes, 8 seconds. My name is Peter McPherson, president of APOU. The report does a nice job of outlining the academic support that's accumulated over the years for the impact of research on the economy. I've been following this issue fairly closely since I was at the Treasury in the 1980s, and actually the accumulation of this research confirmed. And by the way, that research usually links in both the building of human capital plus the impact of the research director. Work this over, it would in fact, it just would be foolish to not cut this off. And long term, if we continue such a path, perhaps Congress would take that long to really change this country. So it's not just GDP, it's where the country is in a generation of money. Secondly, we need to realize that cuts anywhere near like this has a human impact on what people are able to do. Dr. Collins of NIH pointed out the probable impact upon young researchers if these kinds of cuts came into place. And you think about this down at the individual level, that person not getting money to continue, get an opportunity to begin, there's going to have to be something else. And when you leave this screen for 2 or 3 years, you probably have left it for the rest of your life. So we lost that investment in that person. Plus impact upon young scientists who say, well, geez, that's what happened with this group right in front of me or a couple of steps in front of me. What sense does it make for me to continue to do what I'm doing to get there? The last point I would make is that Hunter and I, our two associations, have been working hard about this issue of making points. And I think the certificate here in the room is a letter that we sent to the president and congressional leaders from 154 persons, members of our organization. I yield 47 seconds.
Thank you, Rob. I'm here representing the Semiconductor Industry Association, one of the top American exports over the course of the last decade, and one of the top funders of industry R&D in the nation. Our companies invest between 16% to 20% of their revenues in R&D. And I should note what happened during the downturn. Well, that trend continued. In fact, it went up over the downturn because our companies decided when things are looking bad, now is the time to invest in the future. And that's exactly what they did. And it paid off. In 2011, the worldwide semiconductor industry revenue rose to $299.5 billion, of which the U.S. had 51% of that market share. So there's a solid example for the federal government to take a look at. And again, adopt a long-term growth strategy and move the flawed rationale of the sequestration. our industry also has a long history of successful research collaborations with agencies like NIST, like NSF, like DARPA. And in fact, between 2005 and 2011, our companies invested about $208 million in basic research funding to leverage some of the funding that these agencies are giving about to 40 universities around the country. So what will happen if the sequester goes through? Well, it's anyone's wild guess, but I can tell you those partnerships will suffer. And they will suffer at a critical time in which the U.S. is trying to win a nanoelectronics race in our industry. Right now, we are approaching some of the physical limits that enable you to get that new cell phone or new laptop every couple of years. It's twice as better as the last one. And I know Ronnie will tell you a little bit about what he's doing with semiconductors. But in essence, they're the enablers, and we need to win this race. Others around the world are looking at these ITF reports, are looking at National Academy studies, and they're suggesting to their governments, let's adopt all these recommendations. Well, it's about time someone up here reads these reports, and I'm glad that all of you are here today and are looking at these recommendations. Lastly, I'd just like to carry on with what Peter was saying. It's about the workforce. So this industry has invested in billion-dollar fabrication facilities. They're called fabs. One's up in New York, another one's down in Texas with TI. Intel has made investments in Arizona. And they're co-locating those facilities next to some of the top research institutions in the world. They're doing that strategically because of the research investments that are happening in those universities. And if that investment drops, I can say that there is going to be a negative consequence for our industry. The last point that I'd like to make is that this is so concerning that we'll be sending a letter on behalf of the Task Force on the Future of American Innovation to congressional leaders and the president on the effects of sequestration. And that letter will be signed by six of my CEOs, the presidents of the universities around here today, as well as the presidents of SIA, Tech America, TechNet, and IPI. Thank you.
Thank you, and I get to get the honor of closing this out, and just privileged to be here to talk to you about something that's very important to all of us, and something very near and dear, I think, most of our hearts, and that's the outcome of some of the amazing investment that's happened at the NIH. The Human Genome Project was an amazing project, an amazing example of how government investment in pure discovery research combined with private investment that can take those discoveries and move them through the cycle and become products that actually impact people's lives is a reality. If you think about the $3.8 billion we spent on the Human Genome Project, and today you sit back and look at every dollar we invested produced $141 in economic benefit. We now have an $800 billion economic benefit based on the investment that was made in the Human Genome Project. That project produced an amazing human being, a friend of mine, a colleague, Jonathan Rothberg, whose face you see on this Forbes report. And Jonathan was a byproduct of this process. He was funded by NIH grants. He built several small companies as he gained his PhD at Yale. And those companies were funded by SBIRs, and many of those companies have now produced significant improvements in the area of healthcare. As Ian said, thanks to the investment that was made by the government in the semiconductor industry, we now have the technology, the platform, to now combine Jonathan's amazing understanding of genomics with the semiconductor industry. And today, we have the ability with a chip to take that $3.8 billion investment that took 8 years to map one human genome, and we can synthesize it down to a single genome in 2 hours for $1,000, thanks to these investments. Now, the economic benefit and the technology benefit are one thing, but the people benefit becomes the real important component of this. I doubt there's anybody in this room that isn't touched by some family member or friend who has a complex disease, whether it be an inherited disease, cancer, etc. This is one example on the screen of the real benefit of these types of funding at Adventures, and that is the Joe Berry family, a colleague of mine, CIO at Life Technologies. His kids, he had twins, they were Alexis and Noah, and they were born and diagnosed at birth with cerebral palsy. Fortunately, their mother didn't accept that answer and kept digging and kept digging and kept digging. And finally, through the benefit of gene sequencing, they were able to identify that these children did not have cerebral palsy, but indeed had a mutation of the dopamine cycle within their body. And they were able to get synthetic dopamine and allow them to go from a state, as you'll see on the upper left-hand corner, to now part of a beautiful family that are, you know, top of their class in school and very productive in their community. And so the benefit of these types of discoveries really goes beyond technology and economy. It benefits each one of us. And candidly, it's the way to solve the healthcare crisis in America, innovation. The Lewin Group estimated $70 billion were spent 2 years ago on therapeutics and oncology, and that $20 billion of that had no impact on the patient. But technologies like this chip will allow us to identify the patients that will respond to specific drugs earlier in the disease cycle, allow us to save that $20 billion, but more importantly, get these cancer patients on the right drug at the beginning of their disease state and allow them to have a positive outcome versus metastatic disease. Candidly, sequestration is a very challenging event in our industry if indeed it happens. And I have to say that if this happens, innovation won't stop. It'll just move to another country. It'll be a shame for a country like America that has built the world of innovation and medical technology to hand that off to a foreign country based on the fact that we as a government can't figure out where to spend our money correctly. So, I'd just like to thank you for your time today, and hopefully these messages resonate not only on a fiscal level, but also on a personal level. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ronnie. Before we open it up to questions, I just want to make a couple of remarks based on what we heard. One thing Ronnie did mention, that story of Joe Berry is actually more complicated and much more compelling. And you hear that story personally, how this technology of being able to sequence the genome of those two children really is amazing and heartwarming and moving story. A couple other things. One point you made in the report, I didn't stress it here, and I just want to reiterate it, is the STEM talent issue. We're talking a lot in Washington about STEM talent and our shortages. There's a few evidence that we cite in the report that federal R&D is a major driver of STEM enrollment and graduation in this country at the PS and graduate level. Less of that we would have less, fewer STEM degrees coming up. Secondly, one of the things Ian didn't mention, which I will mention, we have a great semiconductor industry, which is a leading driver of innovation, and a lot of it is certainly done by great companies. But I also need to point out there's several great government programs that partner with the semiconductor industry. One being called the Focus Center program that is DARPA funding, and that funds six centers, I believe, around the country now at major research universities, MIT, I think Stanford, and a few others, in a partnership where they are doing cutting-edge basic research on semiconductor technology, stuff that Intel, no matter how great Intel, just isn't going to do, because it's way, way out in the future. And then they are able to get the real improvements that Intel scientists can then figure out how to develop into the product, or Intel, or IBM, or other semiconductor companies that can take that. That's a very small program, but I think that's a really big thing. One of the nice effects of Focus Center program also to train scientists and engineers who will go out in the industry and actually are input to those firms. And the last thing I would point is one of the things we didn't model, but we heard a lot of anecdotal evidence. We didn't model it because there's no scholarly evidence to let us model it. But that's the international impact here. All the models we looked at were really about just if you have more or less innovation and more or less jobs and more or less GDP. But we didn't model the spatial aspect. So I think it's absolutely right. If we're doing less of this, and other countries are doing more, other countries are already doing more. There's many of the countries we've looked at have been increasing their federal R&D investments 2 to 6 times faster over the last decade in the United States. That makes it a lot easier and almost compelling for companies to go locate over there and get access to those talent and those resources. And if you really want to understand this in a really full way, you really need to read our new book, The Race for Global Innovation Advantage, on sale at Amazon for $19. It just came out 2 weeks ago. So I'll stop talking about it. All right, questions, comments? Just want to raise your hand and say the honor. I'm sure there's somebody who has something. All right, well, in that case, we're not done. I will ask. One of the things that you know, we may hear in some of these debates is, oh, you know, isn't there a waste and, you know, there's sort of, you know, every federal program has got to be a little bit you can tweak out. You're only talking about 9%. You guys, you companies, you all downsize, you're able to tweak things out and get some efficiency. You know, don't we have 9% waste going on in the system? I mean, can't we just do it that way?
When you run a university and you look at the research site, it's an enormously competitive, dog-eat-dog kind of effort with all the professors and somebody competing potentially. Everything, I suppose, could be a little efficient, more efficient. But I think this is one of the more competitive parts of our society.
Last one, Brett?
Yeah, let me take that on for a second. I don't believe there's any human error that had been a little wasted. But in a practical sense, that's really not a factor in sequestration. The reason is sequestration is mindless, and it does not allow for rational planning and reducing costs or prices or anything else. It's very much a straight proportional reduction, and the lack of planning is essentially creating waste in and of itself. In our industry, we saw handwriting on the wall about 3 years ago. Federal spending was going to go down, and overhead and waste is cost to us. So most of our companies looked throughout their organizations and began to eliminate every bit of overhead that they could eliminate. We're through that. We're cutting into muscle now.
Yeah, there's a great line, I forget who said it, I don't know if heard Will say it, that if you want to reduce weight on an airplane, you don't throw the engine overboard.
Yes, my name is Paul Coyle. I'm the Swedish Science Counselor and now my question, briefly stated, is if not for sequestration, then what is there? And if I explain this back more, what would actually be allowed if we didn't have sequestration? Well, as you said, it's not no longer an automatic process, we need some kind of privatization for our not capitalism. And what is actually the realistic prospect of getting investment in innovation and growth policy in that case? I would like to hear your opinion. And personally, I'm fairly optimistic or pessimistic about this. And the reason I'm pessimistic is not because you have a deadlock between two parties, but largely because investments into research and innovation, they are looking for into the future benefits that are coming to see. They are risky investments, generally speaking, and they're also public good investments. And it's difficult to describe or see what the benefits are there. So what are actually the, should we say, optimistic prospects of getting a better prioritization than sequestration within the software?
Yeah, I think first of all, we should have a national effort to basically go over to Sweden and ask them how to do it. I just saw a thing this morning, Sweden, the Swedish Prime Minister just announced a major, serious tax reduction in the corporate tax rate. They'd already reduced it. It's, by the way, it's about 8 points lower than ours. They're reducing it to 4.5 points, something like that. And by the way, their R&D is growing six times faster than U.S. government R&D. Their government R&D grows six times faster over the last decade than R&D. So, I don't know, you figured out how to expand your R&D and cut corporate taxes and you have it. Short answer for me is you just got to deal with entitlements and people that have to work on it. There's no other way around that one. But I'm not going to throw that up. So,
you know, I'm not saying that industry has all the answers here, but I think a lot of solutions have been adopted by industry that are worth taking another look at by the federal government. One example in our industry is the International Technology Roadmap on Semiconductors, it's the ITRS. It plots long-term, where do we want to be as an industry 15 to 20 years out? Companies like Qualcomm and Intel and TI send their researchers, their engineers, alongside engineers and researchers from all over the world and identify short-term, long-term, and really, really long-term obstacles that will inhibit growth in the industry. And then they start sharing that through networks with universities, and there's a sense of prioritization over some of the issues that we're looking at. So I think that's one way to do it. You have to know where you're going, and right now we have really a rudderless ship. I don't know where we're going, and that's a problem for our industry, this uncertainty.
Hunter and then Peter.
I'll just add briefly that it's important to remember that the domestic discretionary budget is a small, small portion of the overall budget. But sequestration hits that budget especially hard. And that seems nonsensical when you realize that what we're talking about here is investment in the nation's future. So this isn't money spent on past things. This is money spent on future things. Investment in research, investment in knowledge, and investment, as Peter emphasized, in our own students, our own children. So this is the worst form, it seems to me, of budget cutting. It's mindless, and it actually falls preferentially on exactly the area of budget that should not be cut.
Well, I think that a lot of sensible people, both parties, understand there's a combination of making long-term investments like research, like education, perhaps infrastructure, and a requirement to not have a cliff to deal with the situation over a relatively short period of time, but then have a clear path to long-term deficit reduction that must entail entitlements, and my judgment must entail some very serious taxes. I think the developments are there. Simpson Bowles, they didn't do entitlements, but that path is there. The question, in my view, is can we somehow or the other get this political system to come together on something sensible? Otherwise, areas like we're talking about today are going to be hit by a truck incidental to the rush.
Yeah, right. I'd like to add to that. I think, in the early 60s, as I was a young boy, I listened to a great president challenge us to go to the moon. And that challenge sent the United States on an amazing adventure of discovery and innovation, and that was both public and private investment that really got us there. And the byproduct of that challenge, we think that from today, computers, semiconductors, even arguing the internet, ability to communicate in the social media world came from that challenge. We stand at that same pinnacle, again, where we have the challenge of genomic medicine, the challenge of the opportunity to take these investments and do something very significant for humankind in terms of how we treat disease and how we manage disease. And I actually think that the real solution is we've got to quit fighting each other on the hill, and we've got to start working together with key issues. And we need more bipartisan, and everybody says that, but the reality is we're at a crucial time in our country. It's time to put down swords and start working together on some of these key issues and solve them. And, I grew up in the Deep South, and my grandmother always taught me, you can't spend more than you make. And I think we have to get back to some fundamental practices, but we have to be able to really, in a very profound way, work together and figure out what money goes where so that we can actually move the country forward instead of the current debates that tend to be so negative and really gets nowhere. So that's an opinion. I may not be sharing all my staff with their life, but it's certainly something I think we should think about.
Yeah, I'm going to go here in the bed just quickly. Yeah, the fundamental point really is we need to distinguish between spending and investment.
Brian Rankin from the National Association of Manufacturers. Rob, you mentioned jobs and a big number, big impact. I wanted to build on a little bit with Mr. Seeker from Thermo Fisher. You talked about sequestration impacting hiring decisions and investment decisions. Obviously, that's for your company. How about the supply chain? How about that support you, that are depending on your business, seeing an impact, have they communicated to you?
Yeah, so as a company, we both depend on our supply chain as well as manufacturing businesses. And I think most of our suppliers, I think, will very pragmatic approach like this. And this ties really to the previous question about the government. How should we look at where our money should be spent? So our suppliers are looking at it and saying, if the U.S. business is going to slow down because of sequestration, I have to get in front of that in advance. Companies have already laid off people, consolidated facilities, because they see coming into 2013 less money being spent in this space, so they're getting ahead of that in advance. Those jobs, some of those jobs are already gone when consolidation is done. They're also taking a very pragmatic approach to it that says we have obligations to grow our business, to continue to provide returns and future responsibility to shareholders. So they're making investments outside of the U.S. when volumes are growing faster. So the long-term dilemma that really happens, we have sequestration that slows down, that research and development slows down. Many companies are going to take their investments, move them outside of the U.S. in the areas that are growing faster. And to balance that equation, to balance budget comment, they're going to cut expenses with like where it's much slower. And that may be here in the U.S. unless we get this thing settled.
The number, just for information, the NIH budget cut, $2.5 billion cut, that equates to about 32,000 jobs if you play that all the way out in terms of losses. And so 32,000, that's not my number, that's the analysts that look at this. So it will have a significant impact on jobs and the loss of jobs as well.
Let me try to put a little bit of number on here. In the aerospace and defense industry, especially the defense side, 70% of every dollar passes through the OEM to the suppliers. And Dr. Steve Fuller, who just completed work on impact on small businesses, calculates that sequestration continues as it is, result in about 950,000 small business jobs. That's
I think I want to comment about the component of this is related to the academic space. And as sequestration happens, there'll be less postdocs hired, there'll be less people who do research. And some of those people who have been educated will now move to other places outside of the U.S. to begin to do research. Like I've received similar.
I'd actually like to sharpen it. Philip Weber, Congressional Budget Office. I'd like to sharpen Mr. Adamson's question a little bit, in specifically with regard to the NIH. The NIH has a very strong peer review process. So the sharpening Adamson's question, it's not that the NIH wouldn't have to cut research, but with a decent peer review process, wouldn't the NIH cut the weakest research first? And in fact, the research, the human genome being a premier thing, theirs might not have been touched at all. So the question I have is a variation of waste, fraud, and abuse, but within the agencies, you would assume that a strong peer review process would work.
That's a very good question. It's just the kind of question it seems to me that ought to be asked, because you might well assume that your question implies that the only thing would be loss would be the weaker proposals. But the problem now is it's already so competitive at NIH that, Harry, what's the percentage of proposers who are funded now?
It's about
1 in 7 to 1 in 10, depending on the age. So somewhere between 1 in 7 and 1 in 10 proposals are now being granted. And many of those that are not being granted are absolutely first rate. So you might say, well, so what? You know, so we're going to miss certain things. The problem is that research is exploding so fast in areas such as genomic research that if we don't stay up with it, other countries are going to go right past us. And just as Edward was saying, our researchers go straight to those countries where the funding is good. And if you don't believe that, all you got to do is try to hold on to faculty members who now have an offer in Singapore. They'll go. So in my view, we're already pretty darn efficient, and this is what Peter was saying a few minutes ago. This is a cutthroat competition. People love to think about academics as a bunch of nerds sitting around while business is out there competing. We compete.
Just one quick point on that. We did another report, I think it's at the end of our initial report, but one of the things we looked at is if you look at the growth of corporate R&D and government R&D from 1957 to 1987, they basically stay on this path like that. After 1987, government R&D is essentially flat. It grows just at the rate of GDP. Corporate R&D is growing. That delta is $110 billion. So I hear your point, but I think if we were putting $50 billion more a year in the federal enterprise, then I'd be saying, yeah, maybe we got a little bit of tighten it slightly, and you're not going to lose that. But we're so far behind where we should be, and
least when I talk to scientists, they tell me that the competition is really just, you know, incredible. Really good proposals that just don't even get funded. Because it's just not enough money to fund all of your proposals.
Hi, I'm Amanda Arden from MIT, the Washington office here. I just wanted to ask, because I've all been very, a great combination of universities and corporations, frankly, that's what we need right now as far as I'm concerned. I did want to ask you, on page 10 of this report, it talks about kind of the feedback loops and the length of time that they should live with kids. And I'm just wondering, do you think, based on your experience on the Hill, based on your experiences in the boardroom or in the classroom, you think people really understand it takes for 1965 to get to the moment, or it takes, you know, people understand, and then the fact that the research actually passed back and forth between industry and agencies and individual spin-offs, why not 100 times back and forth between it? Is there a good enough understanding of that?
Well, I'll just say a quick word. No, there's not sufficient understanding of that, and it's no wonder, frankly. Scientists at our universities are doing things that I don't pretend to understand. It's complex, complicated stuff, and it takes many years to get through it. And a lot of this research starts off because there's simply a really good question someone wants to answer, not because he or she thinks there's going to be a big business payoff, but because someone's interested in nature and natural processes. And it may take 10, 15 years to get there. Well, business doesn't have 10 or 15 years to spend on something that's not going to produce a result. It just can't do it. But government can fund this kind of inquiry-based, curiosity-based research, which you might think sometimes is a big waste of time. And sometimes, frankly, it turns out to be, because you go down a dead end. But there are many times when you go down in a particular direction, and lo and behold, something turns out 20 years later to have fantastic applications in business. Nobody could have predicted it. So it's no wonder the public doesn't grasp that. I don't chastise the public for that. It's hard to understand and to stick with it over many years. That's fair enough.
I agree with Hunter. There's no reason to expect the public would understand this kind of nuance. I do think that what the public can understand are big goals. And it's an important story, it's like the one on the man on the moon thing did galvanize. It was 50 years ago. It had a huge impact, but so too now did the human genome. It may be that along with these individual terrible, wonderful stories, we need to articulate a few sort of galvanizing ideas that people can. There's so many great ideas, it's hard to settle on which ones. But galvanizing big goals do pull along a whole lot of us.
Yeah, I was just going to note that, you know, in our industry, we do something that's amazing to me every couple of years, and that's double the number of transistors on the size of your fingernail. So right now we're about, you know, a billion, billion and a half, and we double that. So figure out how you can put a billion little things on the side of your fingernail. And we're saying, we've got that. You know, it's, and let me say, it's not an easy challenge, but the industry's doing that. We're talking about 2020 and beyond. You know, what is going to be the successor technology that will be used by every company around the world? That's what we're talking about. I also make a note, I'll just carry on with the co-location of the manufacturing facilities. We're making a big deal about manufacturing lately. Those manufacturing facilities, again, are placed next to the top research infrastructure around the country. There are three things that determine where we place that: taxes, workforce, and research. Taxes, we're already in the hole there. We estimate it's $1 billion more to build one of these fabs in the U.S. versus overseas because of the tax structure. That's over a 10-year period. Workforce, you know, 3/4 of the engineers are foreign nationals, and the immigration system is screwed up, so we can't even hire some of these folks. The last thing that the CEOs always point to around my board table is, gosh, well, we have one hell of a research infrastructure. I plead today, don't take that away from us. That is the one last thing that we're really riding on, and we need it.
Rick, you agree.
And
fear for our weather.
Yeah. I just wanted to just address something that I think, again, I come from a very parochial view in healthcare, but the reality is when I cut my teeth in the diagnosis 30 years ago when I first got started, the average trickle-down effect in academic discovery to a community hospital was 7 years, right? And I would argue back then it kind of didn't matter because our knowledge of diseases like cancer were we treated, you know, adenocarcinomas along like squamous cell carcinomas along. But today, with the knowledge that has happened since the Genome Project, we need to work on collaborative medicine because a facility like Sloan Kettering, a facility like MD Anderson, Mayo Clinic, they will never see an aggregate enough patients at the molecular level of a disease like cancer to be able to make conclusive outcomes. But together with all that information in a global central genomic database, allowing everyone to query that, pull information down, and have outcomes management in real time, we can shorten that time from an academic center to the community. 85% of community of cancer is treated in the community. 85%. Think about this. But most of those people end up at an academic center. The drugs can be given in any community hospital. The difference is in access to this evolving genomic diagnostic information at the fingertips of the physician when they see a patient in the community, and then the education of that local physician so they understand what to do with it. So you pose a great point. In my microcosm world, we have to see democratization of this information because it will cut healthcare costs and improve outcomes. So necessity is mother invention. Let's hope that happens.
So great. So let me just close by two quick comments. One, Ian was talking about how we got one out of three going right now, and the 0.0 out of three. A good example of that is an article or a study we did, a report we wrote, and one of the things we talked about was that Texas Instruments a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, was planning to invest several billion dollars in a leading edge semiconductor fabrication facility. And they were looking all around the world and being aggressively courted by countries all around the world, including countries like Singapore. And they ended up deciding to put it in Texas, right next to or near University of Texas. The reason wasn't because they got a good tax deal, they didn't. The reason was because the University of Texas and the Texas state government made a commitment to really beef up the electrical engineering program at UT, and knowing that they could, if they did that, get significant federal dollars to flow in there. And that gave TI the assurance that they were going to be able to get the technical capabilities they needed and the workforce, the high level workforce coming out of that university. So I think that really, at the end of the day, perhaps even the biggest threat of all, less productivity, less startups. Last point I'll make is sometimes colleagues of ours who are on a conservative argument will essentially say, look, it's not that big a deal if we cut federal R&D spending because it's really just a substitute for corporate R&D spending. For every dollar we cut at the NIH, companies like Life Technology and Thermo Fisher will just ramp up their R&D in a couple of Now, they're both laughing here hysterically because they realize how sensible that is. But let me just point out, as we say in the report, the actual scholarly evidence confirms their smiles. Federal R&D is actually a complement to private R&D. The more federal R&D there is, the more private R&D there is in Congress. So we would not only, and again, we didn't model this, we would not only be losing federal R&D if we did this, we would see less corporate R&D in the U.S. Because last one, I just want to again thank my colleague Justin Dix for great work on this report. Thank you to six great panelists here, and thank you all to you, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you very much.